1, 2, 3.
You're listening to Sports Talk Chicago with your host, John Zagluhl.
John, I am fantastic. Thank you for having me. You got an awesome voice, man, and that was a terrific intro. You're like a pro's pro.
You know, that was the first time somebody ever said that, John. No, you're the first person to ever say anything like that. That's very interesting.
You got it, John. Anything for a fellow Chicago guy.
Well, what a great question.
That's a great question. Nobody's actually asked me that.
I like it. What a great question. I never heard that before.
Chase Utley is what? You're saying he's not a Hall of Fame candidate?
You know, it's funny. You may be the only person that I've heard make that connection.
Thank you, John, for having me. I'm doing great. By the way, you have an outstanding voice. Not sure about your face because I haven't met you, but your voice is great.
You're doing a much better job than I ever did. You've had some heavy hitters guests on too, man, so keep up the good work. But it's good to be with you, and I'm ready to talk sports.
Hello, everybody, and welcome into Sports Talk Chicago. My name's John Zagluhl. Great to have you here on the Monday edition of the program, Why Can't the Cubs Hit? We'll explain in just a moment. Plus, a brand new interview today with Professor Alan Sanderson. He's a sports economist at the University of Chicago. We talk with him more about the March Madness and the pay-to-play scandal for college athletics, plus expanding the NFL season and what it means for the future of the league. It's a great interview. And it comes your way near the midway point of this show. Remember, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at John Z Sports and on Facebook at John Zagluhl. And if you want to listen to this show at any time in podcast form, search up Sports Talk Chicago on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and SportsTalkChicago.com. Today's show is brought to you by State Farm agent Brian McDavid. Here's the deal. When you combine State Farm home and auto insurance, you save an average of $889. State Farm agent Brian McDevitt is ready to help you combine home and auto and save in Chicago and the surrounding suburbs. Call Brian today at 630-796-2662. That's 630-796-2662. Or visit his website, ryanismyagent.com. That's ryanismyagent.com. And make sure to mention Sports Talk Chicago. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. I want to start today with this. I get it. It's tough to move on. I know. It's painful. It hurts. If something's been in your life for so long and you're forced to just let it go, it's very difficult to do that, to just drop it and move on. You have to remember, though, the longer you hold on to it, the longer you push back the inevitable, the worse it's going to be. The more pain you'll have. Believe me. If you wait years instead of months, if you put it off, and you refuse to come to that conclusion, when it hits you, you're going to be devastated. It's been 5 years for the Cubs. 5 years since they've won a World Series. 5 years since they've been a legitimate contender. 5 years since they knew how to hit the baseball. And everybody still has hope that they'll finally turn it around. We've heard the same narrative for 5 years. Give it time, give it time. They'll be okay. Oh, if only they could hit, they'd be fine. Oh, they need more reps, more games, new hitting coaches. New managers. They'll be okay. It was Joe Maddon's fault. It was the hitting coach's fault. Albert Almora couldn't hit. Get rid of him. It's been 5 years. Why are we perpetuating the same narrative today? Why are we sitting here thinking it's going to get better? Cubs fans. You have to come to terms with reality. This team that won the World Series, they're legendary, great. But it's time to move on. Nothing is more apparent than the start to this season. The Cubs are going to lose 2 out of 3 to the worst team in baseball. But wait a minute, you think this team is still good, and they should still be competing and contending, and spending money, and acquiring free agents, and making trades, selling the farm. What are we doing here? Everyone's favorite core guys are hitting in some cases under 200. Contreras, Rizzo, Ian Happ, Hayward's right at 200. Javi Baez, 241. The only one who's performing right now is Chris Bryant, ironically enough. This team is hitting .168. I can't believe they're almost .500. It's been the same thing every year. So why are we still clinging to the scraps? Why are we still hoping something's going to change? Isn't it obvious by now? It's over. This team is through. There needs to be a rebuild. There needs to be change. Many of you don't want to hear it. I get it. No one wants to give up this World Series winning core. But the longer you hold on, the more mired in mediocrity this team is going to be. If you don't grow a pair now, realize, yeah, you know what? It's time to be done with this. When will you? When will it be apparent to everybody? That's what I'm asking. Haven't we all seen enough? Don't we all know at this point it's over? Move on. Why are we still clinging to these old players who can't play anymore? I don't understand the infatuation. Talked about this last week. I was on a podcast with Joey Christopoulos. When the White Sox won in 2005, they didn't look back to that team for years and years and lament. They just moved on. 2006, they won 90 games. 2008, made the playoffs. Then they rebuilt. That's it. It's over. No one's looking back today at that White Sox team and thinking, I wish we were there again. No. They're excited for this new team, which I think will win a World Series at some point. See what I mean? The longer Cubs fans and the Cubs themselves look back at 2016, the longer it'll take to win another championship. Tell me I'm wrong. The longer we sit here and just think about, oh, the rain delay. Oh, Game 7, what a comeback. The longer this continues, the harder it is to move on. And if the Cubs don't move on, you'll see more and more of this. Hitting .150 as a team. Can anybody take a hint? This team is not good anymore. They were good. These guys, in some cases, are legends. But it's over. It's over. Stop clinging to these scraps. There is nothing left in this team. Their pitching's good. And that'll help them have a respectable record at the end of the day. But you are not going to win anything when your starting lineup is two hitters hitting above .200. And I get it, it's a small sample size, but this has been going on for years. I hate that argument. It's not like this is the first time ever no one's hit it. It's been happening since 2016, and no one said a word. Or my bad, everybody said a word, and the Cubs have gone out of their way to get rid of certain people and blame them. Joe Maddon, other hitting coaches, it's the players at this point. We've seen it. Anthony Rizzo is a Cubs legend, yes, but he can't hit anymore. Javier Baez is striking out on the same pitches that he's been striking out on for years. Adjustments need to be made.
We haven't seen that. And we've given this team 5 years to do it. Very tough to face reality. Very tough to hear the truth and know that this team isn't what people say they are. Remember in the offseason, everybody said, oh, the division is so weak that the Cubs will just walk their way in and win it. How's that looking right now? The Reds are killing it. St. Louis is okay. Even the Brewers have done their job so far. It's the Cubs who are struggling, and on top of it, they're losing to Pittsburgh. 2 out of 3. To a team that I know is supposed to be rebuilding. And they're losing. Again, they're putting up 1 or 2 runs against the Pirates. Is this enough of a wake-up call for people? Is this enough for people to realize, wow, they're not good anymore? Let's move on. The pitching can only do so much. There will be regression. Won't be bad, but there will be regression. Jake Arrieta is not going to have an ERA of 2.25 all season. It just won't happen. Albert Alzolay will probably not be the fifth starter anymore when it's all said and done. Zach Davies has good control, but when it's off, we've seen what happens. Regression is coming for all these players. So when the pitching regresses and your hitting is still atrocious, what are you going to do? This team will be a 500 team at the end of the day. And I would hope by that point, people will realize we should probably move on. Just like in 2009. I remember, you do too. Cubs were supposed to be very good. They won 97 games the year before, got bounced by the steroid-infused Manny Ramirez and the Dodgers. And everybody said, it's okay, this next year will be their year. 83-79, the next year, Lou Piniella retires midseason, and the rebuild begins. I suspect the same thing is going to happen to this team. A near 500 season, and everyone will realize it's time to move on. But unfortunately, it has to come to this. People have to experience the pain. Could have moved on a couple of years ago, done a quick retool on the fly, been okay. Could have traded away some pieces that were very high in value. Chris Bryant, Rizzo, Baez. All of which now are worthless. Could have done that. A lot of things could have been done to lessen the blow. But instead, we're going to see rock bottom. So be it. That's what it takes for people to realize this team is past its prime. Bring it on. There needs to be closure. People need to realize it's over. And the only way that's going to happen is if this team can't perform. And so far, we're seeing it. People are starting to get these inklings that this team is not what it used to be. Last year proved it a little bit, but everyone blamed COVID because it was a 60-game season. Fine. No more excuses this year. That's it. You can't blame anything or anyone. It's all on them. And besides, the more and more you see your favorite player struggling, the worse it's going to be. No one remembers the greatness of, say, Chris Bryant or Anthony Rizzo or Javier Baez. People are remembering the recent stuff. The struggles, the strikeouts, the criticism. The quicker you move on, the better memories you'll keep. How many people truly remember the Chris Bryant MVP season, compared to today? I don't know about you, but I remember his struggles more than his successes. And a lot of other people are in that boat. Same with Baez. These guys were at one point great players, don't get me wrong. But the longer you hold on to this, the worse their perception becomes in your mind. That's even worse. You're essentially covering up history. If we sit here and just remember the struggles day in and day out of all these players, eventually the World Series will become a blur. Then what? See what I mean? The White Sox did not lament over 2005. They moved on. And today, as much as everybody cherishes that season, Sox fans are looking forward to what they have to come. Why can't the Cubs do the same thing? Do whatever you want. Honor these guys. Give them a plaque, statue, whatever it is. Commemorate what they did, because what they did was historic. But also recognize that all of them are past their primes. There needs to be some sort of moving on, and there needs to be looking to the future. What's next for this team? What more could they do to get back to that spot? It's not happening right now. It's a lot of lamenting and worrying and anguish. Why can't this team hit? Well, they hit before. Why can't they now? The more and more you do that, the more painful it's going to be. You need to move on. You need to realize these guys are legends. But also, they're washed. Start a new core. Build up a new farm system. And in 5 years, you'll be great again, I promise you. Chad Hoyer knows what he's doing. But you gotta let the guy try. I get waiting for some of these players to turn back up and to deal them when their value is high. But the Cubs had opportunities 2 or 3 years ago to do it, and they didn't. And that hurts. It hurts you, the fan. Now this team is still stuck with nowhere to go. And it's 2021. It's 2021, and we're still dealing with this. Same narrative. Same problems. Different coaches, different managers, different management, same problems. They can't hit. At what point will we say it's not the coach, it's not the manager, it's not management, it's the players, and it's time to move on? When will we say that? That's what I want to know. I've been saying it for 2 or 3 years. I get it. There's sentimental value. I know they won a World Series. But come on now. It's been 5 years. There needs to be closure, and there needs to be a period of moving on. If that means another rebound, so be it. You sat through one of them, and it worked out great. Sit through another, and have it work out great again. Holding on to these pieces is only going to hurt you more and more. What did I say to begin this show? It's very hard to move on from something. But the minute you do, the minute you acknowledge it, it gets better. If you hold on for too long, more pain is there. And you're just delaying the inevitable. And when the inevitable hits, it's really going to hurt. Cubs fans, stop delaying the inevitable. You know what's coming. It's pretty apparent at this point. So instead of lamenting and worrying and wondering why they can't hit, why not realize, you know what? There does need to be change. Something new needs to happen. There needs to be a new core and new players. Doesn't mean we can't honor the old ones, but it does mean that they're washed and there needs to be new talent on this team. When that realization comes, the Cubs will be better. Right now, they continue to go down and down, because everybody wants to hang on to the scraps of 2016. Don't do that. Don't hang on to some scraps and lament over what happened 5 years ago. Move on. You'll be better. Everybody will be better, the Cubs included. We won't have to sit here and worry and complain about them not hitting. Eventually it'll be new core, new players, great hitting, great team, World Series. like it did the first time. That can happen, though, unless we're willing to move on. So I hope these past couple of games have put that thought in your mind. It made you think, you know what? Maybe this isn't an anomaly. Maybe this is the cold hard truth. Maybe I should listen and recognize the warning signs. If you do, I promise you, it'll be tough at first, but there will be a lot of good stuff to come. But the longer you sit here and wait, the longer you say, oh, they'll break out of it, the worse you're going to be. More to come here on Sports Talk Chicago. My interview with Professor Alan Sanderson comes up next, so stay tuned. Hey, do you want to make some money this weekend? What if I told you I could offer you $253 to bet on any game you want? Here's what you have to do. Go to sportstalkchicago.com/cash. sportstalkchicago.com/cash. Must be 21 plus. Must be an Illinois resident. You can bet $253 on any game you want for this upcoming weekend. The MLB is back. Cubs, White Sox action. Chicago Bulls, they've been struggling as of late, but they still have some new additions, and the Hawks are still playing. This is, without question, the best time to put down some money and win a whole lot more back. At sportstalkchicago.com/cash. sportstalkchicago.com/cash. You have a gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Talk Chicago, here with John Zagluel, and we are back and ready for today's special guest. He's a UChicago professor of 38 years, a noted sports economist, and a Chicago Life columnist. Please welcome Professor Alan Sanderson to the program. Professor, it's great to have you on again. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thanks very much, John.
So, Professor, what's wrong with March Madness and the college athletic scene?
Oh, I suppose something that's now over 100 years old in a way is the continued, you know, basically monopoly and monopsony power of the NCAA. It's just they have such control over all aspects of the game. And it's something we wouldn't permit in any other part of the economy, but they've sort of been able to fly for 100 years below the radar. However, that may come to an end fairly soon in the next two or three months. On Wednesday of this week, Thursday was opening day for Major League Baseball, but Wednesday was opening day for the Supreme Court in terms of hearing a very now very famous case that's going before the court to attack those elements, especially in the labor market. I was one of a small number of economists, nationally sports economists, who wrote a friend of the court brief on part of the on the part of the plaintiff. So I have particular interest in this case.
What was said in that brief, or what did you touch on when you wrote it?
Well, just basically that we're arguing that the NCAA is basically price fixing, or in this case, wage fixing. In that as an umbrella organization, they set the maximum amount, which is approximately zero, that college athletes can be paid. And it really only affects two sports, really football and men's basketball are the two that are the primary points of emphasis. But that we argue is against antitrust laws for price fixing.
How do you think this whole thing will be resolved in June?
Well, I don't know if I took Wednesday's testimony, the two-hour testimony by the attorneys on both sides, and extrapolated that, I would say the NCAA is pretty much in trouble. Probably seven, if not eight, of the Supreme Court justices were fairly skeptical of the NCAA's argument as to why they had to create or maintain this amateur athletics as they define it.
What's your response to those who say athletes get a free education, that's their paycheck?
Well, in economics, as you know from my courses, there's no such thing as free. In part, they don't get a free education. They don't get the same education that you get at the University of Chicago or even a student at the University of Alabama gets, in that from probably 6 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, the college football player, or men's basketball player, and not only just in season, but well beyond the season, is basically owned by the coach, who tells him when to wake up and when to eat and when to do this and when to do that, and what majors they cannot pursue, what courses they cannot pursue because they conflict with practice or other kind of educational activities. So you don't get nominally they're supposed to work 20 hours a week, and that's just one of the biggest jokes there is. It's basically a full-time job. And let me also add, too, that it may well be that the quarterback at Clemson or the running back at Alabama gets full tuition fees, room and board, and a little walking around money. But the stars on those teams are worth millions of dollars in terms of television and fannies in the seats. So I think of them as the most exploited workers in the U.S. economy.
How could that be fixed?
Well, it's not obvious what would happen. There are several avenues can go. One would be, and in this regard, the NFL and NBA are certainly complicit in that they have rules. Again, you know, when you turned 18, suppose you had a lot of athletic talent and a smart guy. If you wanted to at 18, you could play Major League Baseball. You could be on the professional golf tour, actually play in Augusta this weekend in the Masters, assuming you're good enough. You can join the professional rodeo. You can drive an Indy car. Those are all legal. You can work for Macy's. You can join the Army. There are just two occupations you can't do. You're not allowed to play professional basketball. You're not allowed to play professional football. And that's just an anomaly. And also one that where, again, the NBA and NFL are just in collusion with the NCAA in this regard. The two professional leagues get their training provided for them for free and get a couple more years of maturity behind the kid before they're drafted or before he enters the professional leagues. One thing could be that, in fact, like Major League Baseball has minor leagues, it would force the professional basketball and football leagues to actually have their own development programs and sort of minor league teams. That's one outcome. Another, and I think it would pass antitrust muster easily, is that if the NCAA ceased to exist and just went poof, the decision-making units wouldn't be the NCAA, but it could be the conferences. So the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the SEC, the ACC. If you had a half dozen conferences dictating what they wanted to do, that would pass muster, just as we wouldn't like one airline in the United States. But, you know, we have four domestic airline carriers say, that may be enough to provide some level of competition. So I think you could have that. The Pac-12 could say, look, we'll just play within our conference. We won't play outside the conference. And we're freed at that point to set our own rules for how the Pac-12 would operate, and the Big 12 or the Big 10, how they would operate. And so that's another way that it could turn out. And an extension of that is, you know, universities pay their professors. They pay the people who mow the lawns. There's no reason why they can't pay the athletes.
Is there an ethical problem with paying athletes to you?
No, I don't see that. If I go back 100 years, if I go back 50 years, there wasn't all that much money in college athletics. It was a sort of, you know, a small business, as it were. Nobody made a whole lot of money. The same was true of baseball players or football players or others before free agency, before unionization. They didn't make a whole lot of money either. They made a nice salary, but not outrageous. If I give you an example, given the NCAA men's final game is tonight, in 1984, in inflation-adjusted dollars, CBS paid the NCAA $15 million, $15 million with an M, to broadcast March Madness. This year, I don't have this year's numbers because it's not yet, and there wasn't a 2020 tournament because of COVID. But in 2019, the last tournament played, CBS and its affiliates paid the NCAA $1.1 billion with a B. Okay, that's a hell of a lot of money. Okay, and you get football coaches, basketball coaches walking around making seven-figure, in some cases eight-figure incomes. If you ask, if I take the 50 states in the United States, in 45 of those 50 states, the highest paid public official in the state is not the governor by a long shot. It's the football coach or the basketball coach. I mean, the head football coach at the University of Illinois is by far the highest paid public official in the state of Illinois. Coaches make a ton of money, and in part because there are two things. One is you're not paying the players, so you move to the next avenue. The second is television. It's just that's what happened between 1984 and today is television. So, I mean, to the extent you ask, you know, I think this is an ethical issue. I do think it's an ethical issue, not in the way you meant it, but in the way of, yeah, it's an ethical issue because these kids are being exploited so much. Okay. Let me also add, too, and it's another element in here. If you take a look at the game tonight, or if you took the 64 teams or the 68 teams in the tournament, in the men's tournament, and walk through them. Of the 10 starters in tonight's game, I think seven of them will be black, and that's about the percentage across the board in Division I basketball, men's basketball. So basically, you've got the people who are the most exploited workers, and they are workers out there on the court. They may be having fun, but they're working and generating millions of dollars. They're basically black. And I think we ought to be ashamed of ourselves for doing that.
Professor Alan Sanderson here on Sports Talk Chicago. Professor, let me ask you this. Do you see college athletics not existing at one point in the future?
I think it's possible. Well, existing in the form that it exists now, I think it could exist, you know, let's call it Division III, University of Chicago level, in that it could be just another sort of thing that you do. You know, you join a fraternity or sorority, or you participate in this kind of club sport or Model UN or whatever the activity may be, but not at this gigantic level that we've gotten to. I think that's entirely possible, and I don't think necessarily bad. We've got professional leagues here, so it could, you know, flop down to sort of a D3 level. That's entirely possible, and in part because the other is there are massive amounts of revenue, as I've said, that go into, and it's basically two sports, football and men's basketball, that go into that, but in addition to the revenues that come in, there are expenditures that go out. Again, paying a coach $10 million and so forth. Or building basically what's a swimming pool with the University of Alabama as part of their training center for the football team. It's just this kind of just asinine expenditures. And the reason colleges do it is they're not paying the players. And so you have to spend money in other ways to show you what great facilities you have, or having the world's best coach or something like that. That's the way you recruit the athletes. if they were paid. I mean, the University of Alabama has far better facilities for its football team than the Chicago Bears do, in part because the Chicago Bears pay the players, and the players would just as soon have the paycheck as opposed to a swimming pool. And they use the paycheck for the recruiting device. The other is, because of this, one often talks about the revenue that comes in, but one also should talk about the expenditures that go out within the athletic department. And by that, I mean that except for probably, I would say, around 15 Division I football teams out of the 150, 160 teams that exist now, only about 15, maybe 20, actually make money. The rest of them all lose money. And one of the things, in response to your question of could I see college football or basketball going poof, going away, at some point, a university president or the board of trustees might decide, look, we've got to pay these guys now. We can't afford that. We're already losing money. We're going to lose more money. We just can't afford to do that. And so it may well be that you'd move from 150 Division I football teams down to maybe 50, 60, something like that, the power conferences. And the rest would just go away because universities would make a decision. This is costing us too much money. We can't afford to do this any longer.
How do you feel about that, to see lesser programs but more players be paid?
I think it's a trade-off I'm willing to support. And again, we have, you know, 30, around 30 pro teams in basketball and football. There's no reason if we had 50, say, call it Division I high-powered and players are being paid in college athletics, that's sufficient number. Okay. Another element that's happening as also going to be and in this Supreme Court case is some legislation that was passed in California a year or two ago. It sort of gets called pay for play legislation, which has now been passed in several states. The sort of shorthand for it becomes what's called NIL, N-I-L, name, image, likeness. When I play on a, you know, Division I basketball team or Division I football team for the NCAA, I sign a contract that basically says the NCAA owns me for the rest of my life. Okay? That they own my name, they own my likeness, they owe my image. I can't make any money off that. I can't sell my image. But the legislation that's in those states and is going to just sort of keep adding until it gets to close to 50 probably, is that the athlete owns his image, or in the case of some non-revenue sports, her image, and that the athletes can prosper by basically trademarking that image. That's one of the sort of, you know, the doors opening. And that's already law, takes effect a year from now.
So we could see athletes, in theory, be able to have endorsements in college. That's going to happen.
That legislation is not going away. California was the first state, but as I say, they're now something seven or eight. It's on its way. The number is just going steadily up.
Professor Alan Sanderson here on Sports Talk Chicago. Professor, what's your take on the NFL's extra game beginning in 2021?
Well, it's sort of an extra game with an asterisk in that the total number of games doesn't change because they add one regular season game and they drop one of the preseason games. So instead of 4 plus 16, it's 3 plus 17, which is about the same sum. The preseason games are fairly worthless, but again, it's been a way in which the NFL can force season ticket holders, which is basically everybody, to pay for something they really value at far less than the ticket price. I suspect it's okay in that it was negotiated between the ownership and the player side. So, you know, some are more in favor of it as the others than the other side of the table. But it was a negotiated contract, so I'm okay with that. Let me add another element of this, coming back to the NCAA issue. Again, could have had, possibly, barring, you know, the way the game ended the other night, a fabulous game between Gonzaga and UCLA. If I go back to the heyday of UCLA back in the 60s, when they were the dominant team and the legendary coach John Wooden, the team, when UCLA was playing the last game for the championship, their total season was about 25 games. Tonight, I assume, and again, it's a little tricky because of COVID and some games got canceled, including an earlier Gonzaga-Baylor game. But in a regular season, say in 2019, or even tonight, if I throw in the COVID games that got canceled, the two teams on the court are probably playing somewhere around their 40th game. The season has expanded enormously. Why? Because you're not paying the players. Okay. You can keep playing games. Why? We don't have to play these guys. We don't have to pay these guys. Or traditionally, if I go back 50 years, the football schedule was 10 games, a 10-game season for the powerhouses, and then they go to a bowl game, so maybe they play 11 games. I assume this last year, who won the national championship, was probably playing their 14th, possibly 15th game. And there's been a tremendous increase in the length of scheduling. Why? You're not paying the players. Something, you know, would the NFL like to go to a 25-game schedule? No. Why? Because they'd have to split that money with the players. And it just, beyond some point, doesn't make sense. They don't net enough to expand the schedule. So it does from 16 to 17. Would it go to 20? Probably not, because they couldn't make enough money off it to justify it, given the half they have to give to the players. But when you're not paying the players, sure, let's keep playing.
Yeah. You know, in the NFL's case, and we've talked about this a bit before in class, the idea that players aren't safe anymore. They're leading with their heads because helmets have become more protective versus the 1950s when they were leather and there was nothing to protect them. Do you feel like this is a bit hypocritical by the NFL, that they advocate for player safety, but then they turn around and add an extra game?
Yeah, well, again, I'll grant you it's an extra regular season game, but it's not. They're still playing 20 games, not more than that. Some of it you just can't do much about, or the unintended consequences. Also, again, if I go back 50 years and say what was the average weight of an NFL player versus today, I'm making this up, but I'm guessing that the average player today weighs 30 or 40 more pounds. And the laws of physics still apply in terms of force equals mass times acceleration. And that mass has just increased tremendously. So they're running at each other harder. Also, you give them safer helmets, helmets that provide more safety, they're just going to run at each other even harder. If you wanted no injuries or very small number of injuries, you just have guys out there wearing cleats and be nude. You would see far fewer injuries at that point. Okay. Again, these unintended consequences, sometimes you can't do anything about it. It turns out, if you look at the COVID period, the last year, and take a look at automobile deaths, you would think that they would have gone down. There are just fewer people driving. They're not driving to work. They're working from home. The malls are closed. The restaurants are closed. And Americans drove far fewer miles last year than they did the year before. But automobile deaths increased. Why? There are fewer cars on the road. They're going faster because there's less congestion. And so the increase in automobile safety has just gone down. Drivers are driving faster. They're driving less with their seatbelts on. They feel safer because there are just far fewer cars out here on the road. And they're driving when they're drunk, or they're driving when they're texting more than they did before. And so you would think, oh, there are going to be fewer automobile deaths than there were the year before. No, there are more. And so the same thing with injuries. You'd think, gee, we've got safer helmets. These guys will, you know, get fewer injuries. No, they're going to get more because they're just going to run at each other harder.
More to come with Professor Alan Sanderson in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is Sports Talk Chicago.
Professor Alan Sanderson, still here on Sports Talk Chicago. Professor, a few more questions before we finish up. First off, the most rewarding part of your teaching career is what?
Oh, overwhelmingly, it's something I haven't enjoyed for the last year, and that's just the interaction with students. And I don't want to get in trouble with some other university in the United States, but there are a lot of universities where I would look at students as liabilities, not assets. And I wouldn't want to spend a whole lot of time with them. But at a place like the University of Chicago or elite private higher education or even public higher education, I enjoy very much just the give and take and interaction in the classroom, office hours, intersections on campus with students. And I miss that immensely. Zoom is a wonderful technology, but it's no substitute for in-class training. So I miss that. And being able to just enjoy very bright, motivated students. And it's, you know, the University of Chicago has done as well as could be expected, but the product that we had to deliver over the last year is just a shadow of what college is really like. And I feel very sorry for the students. It's a very important, valuable, enjoyable four-year experience for most of us. And I say especially the first-year students have probably been deprived most because they never really got a chance to, for the most part, be on campus and interact, make friendships, and enjoy college, where the second or third year, even fourth year students have had a few years of those sort of normal experiences. Again, they've still been deprived of a lot, and at an elite institution like the University of Chicago, so much of what one learns for a student is not from the faculty member, is from fellow students, the other 2,000, you know, people in your class who are bright and motivated, and you're arguing in the gym and the library and the dorm and the cafeteria line. That's a valuable part that we just can't replicate. But I miss, overwhelmingly, I miss the interaction with the students.
What about the most difficult part? Pre-COVID, what would that be in teaching kids?
Are you thinking about during pandemic or just in general?
Just in general.
I suspect one of the things, and it affects me the more than most, or maybe more than any. You know, I teach so many students. I don't know if I've ever said this to you before, but I've taught more students than anybody in the history of the University of Chicago.
Wow.
And I don't mean just in economics. I mean everywhere. You know, I have just taught more students. Where was I going to go with that comment? I think for me the most difficult is that my class sections are large. This year, you know, they're running 200, 250 for each course with COVID. But before that, each course would be sort of 150 to 175, something like that. I don't get to know them as well, the students as well, or interact as much as if I were teaching classes of 25. students in a class in several departments that I could mention, but won't for good reason. So the advantage for the faculty members is they do get to know the students a lot better.
And Professor, before we finish up today, last question. What's the funniest moment that you've been a part of in your career?
Oh, gee, that's a good question. One I actually had about 6 months ago as a former student. I had, it turns out, about 30 to 40 years ago, somewhere in that range, at another institution, who just wrote a new book. And the book was dedicated to me. And I'm not sure if she was an econ major or not, and I quite frankly can't remember a whole lot about her, but that she dedicated the book to me and said, you know, for teaching economics and how important scarcity is, and also that we should pay more attention to Uncle Milty. Okay. That Uncle Milty being Milton Friedman. This was not at the University of Chicago, but I guess even that long ago, I was still sort of, in awe of Milton Friedman's economics and as a person. So that was an interesting moment.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you every year and talk about sports economics. Let's hope we can do it again soon. And best wishes to you as the spring quarter kicks off.
Okay, John, and to you too. Hope things continue to go well for you. Be safe or sane, one or the other.
Great talk there with Professor Alan Sanderson, and that'll do it for us today here on Sports Talk Chicago. Big thank you to Professor Sanderson himself, Matt Dubio, WCKG, Jim DeTalb, and Tomorrow Entertainment for making this show a success. Remember, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at John Z Sports and on Facebook at John Zagluo. And if you want to listen to this show at any time in podcast form, search up Sports Talk Chicago on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and SportsTalkChicago.com. Another great show comes your way tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening. Till then, stay safe, and so long, everyone.
No! No! Mirror the turtle!